Do we finally have something substantive to say about vitamin D?
Whooping cough in school-aged children.
Can we improve the ability of mammography to detect breast cancer?
And under-detecting heart problems as a cause for strokes.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 27th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, we're going to send out a big thank you to a listener who wrote into you and said, wow, you know what? I'm having a lot of trouble with my iTunes account. We are migrating, and therefore, people need to really get in there and check out that link to iTunes to make sure they have the proper subscription link. So that's just a reminder, we really are still out there, we really are still broadcasting, and we really want you to listen to us, so please update.
And our thanks to Brad for alerting us to this problem.
So let's turn to one that's garnering a tremendous amount of media attention. That's a technique called tomosynthesis for improving the utility, shall we say, of the detection available with mammography. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Let me kind of let our listeners know what tomosynthesis is. It's a way of detecting breast cancer by using an X-ray source that moves around the breast in an arc. And it allows us to get pictures in thin slices, kind of like a CT scan. The real question is whether tomosynthesis does a better job when combined with routine mammography than just mammography by itself. And that was the source of this study, in which they, over two different time periods, one time period where they did just digital mammography, and then they used digital mammography with tomosynthesis. They had almost 500,000 examinations, and they expressed it as a rate per 1,000 people examined. First of all was the recall rate. When you do these tests, how often do you have to call somebody back because the results are inconclusive? And the recall rate was less when tomosynthesis was used. It decreased it by about 16 individuals per 1,000 screened, or about 15%. You say, well, did it alter the way that the cancer was detected? Maybe, in fact, we're detecting less cancer. Well, that wasn't the case. In fact, there were more cancers detected when the modalities were combined than when digital mammography was used alone. So this study seems to suggest that the addition of tomosynthesis to digital mammography was associated with a decrease in a recall rate and a modest increase in cancer detection rate.
Okay. However, as we're so fond of always putting out there, what about that hard endpoint, deaths from breast cancer? Clearly, we can't know that kind of data regarding this technique at this point. But also, what about the cost of it?
Well, bingo. I'm glad you brought that up because we just reported the facts. Let's put it in perspective. There are three things that people need to consider. One is, what's the cost? And it looks like there's about a $50 to $100 cost out of pocket to the individual. Second question you ask is an important question. Does it really affect mortality? So what if we detect cancers earlier? We know that some of the cancers actually regress on their own. There's about a 10% risk of over-treatment of cancers, and where the cancer treatment has improved substantially so that early detection isn't nearly as important. So this study doesn't address that. And the third thing that our listeners need to be aware of is this doubles the amount of radiation exposure that a woman gets. So I think it's important that our listeners realize that despite the fact that it sounds like this ought to be the method of detection of choice, there are really a lot of unanswered questions.
And we'll wait and see. We'll take that posture, again, a favorite posture for us. Let's turn now to what I served up as, wow, that we finally have something substantive to say about vitamin D. That's in The Lancet, and I find this a very interesting study. So it's the relationship between vitamin D and hypertension with a genetic analysis. Wow, this is over the top.
This was an interesting study in that it associated vitamin D status with arterial blood pressure and hypertension based upon Mendelian characteristics. What's the likelihood that someone could inherit a trait that would alter their vitamin D either synthesis or their use of vitamin D as a substrate? What the study showed was that in looking at analysis in almost 150,000 individuals, that each change, 10% increase in plasma and vitamin D levels determined by genetic differences was associated with a decrease in both diastolic blood pressure of about a third of a millimeter, a decrease in systolic blood pressure by about a third of a millimeter, and an 8% reduced risk of high blood pressure. The value of this particular study is these genetic abnormalities persist since birth. So it gets rid of some of the confounding characteristics that one has when one has an observational study. Let's put this in perspective, though. One is, this is a very modest change, and there's a likelihood that this is just due to chance. Furthermore, we've done studies in which we've given vitamin D, and it doesn't appear to lower blood pressure. Those randomized trials make us wonder really how robust this particular finding is. So, Elizabeth, what are your thoughts?
I think it's really interesting because it suggests a possible mechanism for the relationship between vitamin D and all-cause mortality, which we also saw in another recent study. And we chose last week or the week before that, and that was a study that was in the BMJ. We chose not to do that on the podcast, and I disparaged it because I said, wait, it could be a bystander. We don't know if it's the vitamin D that causes this problem with mortality, or it's just like, okay, you don't feel well, so you don't go outside, so therefore you don't get sun exposure and you don't synthesize vitamin D. So this study at least is attractive to me because it posits a mechanism, and I really love those mechanism kind of things.
Your point's well taken. I'm glad you mentioned the things that you did. So we're looking for confirmation, but you're right. It may actually be that causality that we're looking for.
Let's turn then to the BMJ. Let's take a look at pertussis or whooping cough, something that we've been seeing a huge recrudescence of in this country, and a persistent cough in adolescents.
And the reason why I picked this particular article, because whooping cough or pertussis is one of the most common vaccine preventable diseases. It causes nearly 300,000 deaths a year in children worldwide. The current recommendation is that children get vaccinated at a very early age, at 2, 3, and 4 months of age, because the people that are most susceptible to dying from pertussis are the very young and the very old. The unfortunate thing is we've reported that immunity seems to wane, seems to last for 4 to 12 years. Consequently, it's recommended that just before school, children get a booster. The question this study asked and answered was, well, when adolescents develop a cough, and particularly a persistent cough, how often is it due to pertussis? So they looked at 279 school-aged children that presented with a persistent cough. That is, it lasted for somewhere between the 2 to 8 weeks duration. They collected oral samples looking for immunoglobulin to the pertussis, indicating they had a recent infection. And what they discovered was that 1 in 5 of the children who had a persistent cough actually were positive for pertussis. Almost all of them had been vaccinated as infants, and the majority, 80%, had received a booster preschool. This tells us that we need to consider another booster in adolescents.
This, of course, is a very concerning problem. I think this is a useful study in that it helps us to determine the baseline of infection in people in whom we may not suspect that whooping cough is a problem.
The major reason to prevent infection in adolescents is not because it's deadly. The real issue is whether adolescents or adults who get it will pass it on to infants.
I think also the other population you didn't identify was the elderly, so that if adolescents are shedding viruses, they could easily give that off to grandma and grandpa.
And that reminds me to tell our listeners that, at least in the United States, it's recommended that individuals over the age of 50 receive a pertussis booster vaccination as well.
Excellent. Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, so-called cryptogenic stroke and atrial fibrillation.
Cryptogenic means we don't know what the cause is. And it's interesting, people that have had a stroke or a TIA, despite doing an extensive workup in 20 to 40% of individuals, we can't identify what the source of the stroke is. We call it cryptogenic. We know that a major cause of stroke is atrial fibrillation. In atrial fibrillation, the upper chamber of the heart doesn't contract synchronously. It kind of quivers. Clots can form in that upper chamber, dislodge, and travel to the brain where they cause a stroke. We have effective ways of preventing that. The use of anticoagulants, older ones like Coumadin or Warfarin, or newer ones that we've talked about. But we only give anticoagulants if someone is shown to have atrial fibrillation. So what these two studies did, they did all the routine tests to show that they were in fact cryptogenic. And then they did an interesting thing. They said, maybe since atrial fibrillation occurs intermittently, they put in a monitor underneath the skin that monitored the heart rate continuously for 6 months. In the other study, they put a 30-day monitor on. They detected atrial fibrillation at a rate 5 times higher than an individual who only had a 24-hour Holter monitor.
Okay, that's really interesting. The other part that I would do would be to slap these people on these anticoagulants and see whether or not that impacted on a second stroke. Because if they have atrial fibrillation that's really intermittent and you're going to put them on a medication that they're going to need to take all the time, there's a risk-benefit thing that's going on there.
You're right. So that's the follow-up study. But let me stress, in the current recommendations, if you detect atrial fibrillation with a 24-hour monitor and you put someone on aspirin, you decrease the risk of subsequent strokes by only about 25 or 30%. You put them on anticoagulants, you decrease that risk by 60 to 80%.
Okay. On that note, I will reveal that I think this week on the blog, I think I'll do the tomosynthesis for breast cancer detection because I think a lot of people are paying attention to that one. Although I really do like this cryptogenic stroke one a lot too, I have to say. It's hard to tell, you know, when you're a nerd to pick between those two, but I think I'll do the breast cancer detection.
I agree, Elizabeth. You've got a high nerd titer, but it serves the podcast very well.
All right. Thank you so much. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.